Then the underground cloud cracked, melted, and the lark fell upward to our world. To read the light around the lark, imagine you've chiseled part of you away, an old part at the beginning of a succession of your childhood bodies. You fall upward from your previous body out of the melting ice. And when you look back on each body, if you will brush them carefully, if you will chisel what is not you carefully, you'll know that each is still bewildered and desiring to stay in what it must believe is the only world, the one that's safe, the real one.
And that's what you learned as you wrote this book. And that is what you learned. The voice of David Keplinger. The book is Ice. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinibit Fund, Rivada Foundation, the Maryland State Council for the Arts, Natalie Canavore, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and our engineer is Mike Turpin.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Good morning, and welcome to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform, which means we are funded by you, the listener. Today, we peek into the British Film Institute's new monograph on the Lee Marvin thriller, Point Blank. And Jeff takes us on another tour of an essential of cinema. But first, Mona Bowen joins us again to discuss further some good TV watching, including The Three Body Problem and the British comedy series Extraordinary.
I've been watching a show called Extraordinary.
Yes.
I think you can find it. It's streaming on Hulu. A lot of people have. And this, it's the second season is out. It is truly one of the funniest things I've ever seen. Now, comedy is very subjective. I do realize that. But this is, there's something about this show. It's just nuts. It really tickles me. I laugh aloud at least once an episode and generally more. And it's about this young woman who they're in a kind of parallel universe to ours. It is the planet as we recognize it, same countries and people, you know, what foods and all of that. But the difference is that this young woman, Jen, lives in a world where everyone gets their superpower at age 18, right?
So I see.
But she does not. And she doesn't know what her superpower could be. She doesn't have one. And everyone has weird, some of the superpowers are so berserk. You know, I don't even want to go into it, but
right.
But they're really like, they're not, many of them are not useful.
He was such a brave little soldier.
Carrie, I haven't got a power yet. I'm not, like, terminal.
Mommy, Daddy, look at me.
Oh, you do know you're not going to get your power the second you turn 18? I'm super strong!
We're just going to ignore the fact she broke the fridge.
That's very high.
I want a power. I want one so badly.
Why are you staring at a dog?
Nah, it's not a dog. That's a demon.
I'm not depressed. I'm in the middle of a redemption arc.
I'm gonna sort your life out.
My cousin was like you, and he went to one of those clinics.
Are you looking to start your power journey today?
Yes, I am, Denise.
I'm scared nothing will change, and then I won't even have hope. I'll just have me.
What else do they recommend?
Long walks, sex, spicy food.
You're looking at how to induce labor.
No, I'm not. Oh, how dilated is your cervix?
Many of them are not useful, but everyone gets one. So she feels she is surrounded by friends, though, who are very supportive. She works in a party shop, like a shop where you go to get party stuff and
balloons and whatnot
and things like that. It's a British show, and she is on its feet. I just can't even explain it. If you have to have like that British sense of humor, it is dry. It is stupid. It is ridiculous. It is absolutely, I think, listen, I don't know how to, it's bonkers. In the best way, it is completely ridiculous. And I just laugh so hard. The situation she gets, I cannot even explain to you. And it is, every time someone has a choice to make, I can promise you they make the wrong choice.
Oh, of course.
But that's where a lot of the humor comes from. And I absolutely love it. I wasn't familiar with any of the actors in this show, but the main actress is Mairead Tyres. So she's, I got that wrong because this is a completely Irish name. I apologize. But she's hilarious. Her best friend and roommate, Sophia Oxenham, are really very funny too. Now, she might be more familiar. She was in Poldark, that series.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And then we just go on from there. So it's kind of semi-familiar faces. But I think that one of the things that makes it truly joyful to watch is the actors are not very familiar. So there's no baggage of who they are or how they're going to be, you know?
Yeah, well, I'll wait for when they do an American remake.
Oh, please don't do that. It's going to be lesser.
I tease. I just, I kid. Yes, I kid television.
But anyway, listen, it's available on Hulu. So you don't need it. Okay.
What is the Three Body Problem also there? Or is it on some other streaming service?
Three Body Problem is on Netflix. And again, now we're another deep swerve into something, a completely different direction. Three Body Problem is based on a Chinese book.
Chinese science fiction.
And then based on an Asian series, but now we are now in the UK. It's very difficult. I mean, a lot of it is set in China. This is a show that is really hard to put your finger on. I would say it's speculative science fiction, but it is also deeply human. It is not an easy show to, you have to pay attention. This is not a show to watch. Something else is going on around you.
While you're
this
knitting a sweater or something like that.
Well, I mean, I suppose you could. I was doing some embroidery while I was watching it, but it is a show you do. It is very visually rewarding, and you do, and a lot of it does take place. I mean, of course, we're watching TV, so of course visual, but there are things you will miss if you're not being attentive.
I'm guessing that a lot of the key points are made with camera movements, settings, objects, looks.
Well, there's some visual effects you don't want to miss.
Yeah.
There are absolutely some visual effects you don't want to miss. But what is really important, and I'm not giving anything away here, it takes place in several different times. One time frame is the Cultural Revolution in China, which was a terrible time for scientists, as we know. And another is now the contemporary, taking place all around the world, but primarily the UK, at least as we get into the show. And there are a lot of really familiar faces, but one of the most familiar faces for anybody is going to be Benedict Wong, who is a well-known, he's a fantastic actor. I love him. He's very, I don't know what it is about him. I mean, even if he's playing sort of a very silly part, like in the Marvel universe, his intelligence and his wisdom and his humanity always come across in those parts. He always has kind of an air of not suffering fools gladly, but you know, he'd be there if you needed him. You know what I mean? That kind of thing. He's very wonderful. And there's a whole bunch of other actors. Rosalind Chow, who I don't think we see nearly enough of, plays an older version of a younger actor in the Chinese time frame. And so it's going to be a lot. Jonathan Pryce, who is absolutely one of my all-time favorite actors, always. I think he just, every time I see him, his voice. And then John Bradley, who is also well-known mostly from Game of Thrones. It is a multicultural cast. It is, and it is a very, very intelligently written show. It doesn't give things away, but it does not withhold either. So, because I really hate those shows which have mysteries to them, and at the end they're solving the mystery and you're like, why didn't you tell me that episode one? That was an obvious thing you should have said. Duh, you withheld from me a solution. You are learning what is going on as the characters are learning.
Oh, right? Okay. Yeah.
And I really, really liked it. It's smart.
We should note produced by the same duo who did Game of Thrones, I believe.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So, and it does not talk down to the watcher, though. I mean, truly, like it does reward. It is, and in fact, it is a series I think I may rewatch. Actually.
Oh yeah, may I have to.
Which I don't often do because there aren't enough hours in the day. But this is one that I'm like, this is. I do want to go. I did find myself even as I was watching it. I'm only a couple of episodes in, and I am beyond intrigued. you know.
So this is a provisional thumbs up.
I think I'm going to be happy.
Okay.
You know, I would be really disappointed if they screw it up, you know.
Well, anyways, here we are. We've been talking to one of our favorite contributors, Mona Bowen. And we discussed Extraordinary and The Three Body Problem.
Yes, all recommended, yeah.
Oh.
Mona will be back next week with more considerations. And you're listening to Film 11 here on Community Radio KBOO Portland. Please consider becoming a member today, as your support helps us maintain our fantastic library of radio shows. Well, now let's turn to Jeff Godsell on his latest Essentials of Cinema.
The 1960 American Western, The Magnificent Seven, is an anomaly in cinema history, a remake of a foreign language film that was itself an homage to the remake country's generic genre, the Western. Akira Kurosawa was a big admirer of John Ford when he wrote, directed, and edited his masterpiece of Japanese cinema, The Seven Samurai, in 1954. The rights for the U.S. remake were bought by producer Lou Morheim for $2,500. Morheim hooked up with Yul Brynner's production company with the idea of Brynner actually directing, as he had done for television, and with Anthony Quinn as the star. But when Brynner approached famed producer Walter Mirisch and a deal was finalized with United Artists, Quinn and Brynner had a falling out. Quinn eventually sued Brynner, but lost, as nothing was in writing. And when Martin Ritt was slated to direct, Brynner became the star. After all, he had been the king in The King and I. Eventually, it would be John Sturges who became the director, and much more, as he would have a hand in the casting and the structure of The Magnificent Seven. The first draft of the film was commissioned by Morheim for writer Walter Bernstein, who was then still blacklisted. Bernstein's draft stayed close to the original by Kurosawa and his writers, but Mirisch and Brynner brought a writer, Walter Newman, on board, who had worked on Ace in the Hole for Billy Wilder and The Man with the Golden Arm for Otto Preminger. It is Newman's script that is considered to be largely what's on screen. The fact that his name doesn't appear on screen is his own fault, something that he would later regret. When Newman refused or was otherwise unavailable to travel to the shooting location in Mexico, another writer, William Roberts, was hired in part to make any changes required by the Mexican censors. Roberts also supplied some juicy character-driven dialogue, and when he asked the Writers Guild for co-credit, Newman, in a huff, asked for his name to be removed. As a result, only Roberts' name appears in the credits. In Kurosawa's original film, it's a small Japanese village in the 16th century that's being regularly attacked and robbed by an array of bandits. Political structures are changing in Japan, and skilled samurai, once attached to powerful shogun, now have no masters and subsequently no work. It is to them that the villagers look to help save them from the bandits. In adapting the story for The Magnificent Seven, which was, by the way, the title for the Japanese film in the U.S. when it was first released in 1955, the action moves to a small village in Mexico. A gang of bandits, led by a character named Calvera, continuously raids the village for food and supplies. And they put up with it, but when a villager is shot and killed by Calvera, they decide to fight back. Three of the villagers cross the border into the U.S. into a small town in the hopes of buying or trading for guns. By chance, they meet Chris, a veteran gunslinger clad in black, played by Yul Brynner. Chris suggests they look for men to help protect the village because he says these days, men are cheaper than guns. They agree, and at first, Chris just tries to recruit, but eventually becomes the leader of the group. One by one, Chris puts together the team that would become the Magnificent Seven. And here, in the casting of the remaining six, can be found one of the secrets as to why The Magnificent Seven is as good as it is. Director John Sturges had directed 30 films at this point, and while many of them are far from stellar, he developed a firm philosophy of how and why his films would work. Behind whoever the star was, he would emphasize the character actors. Once you have the head, he would say, I'll look for the guts. Sturges was involved in the casting of each of the six supporting players behind Brenner, and of Eli Wallach as Calvera, who was more surprised as anyone that he'd be playing a villain. To accompany Brenner and to act as a kind of sidekick, Sturges wanted Steve McQueen. McQueen had only a handful of films to his credit, like The Blob, but had found new TV fame with the series Wanted Dead or Alive on television. Sturges and McQueen conspired to wrestle him away from the shooting schedule of the series, which is explained in an amusing story on the bonus material of the DVD of Magnificent Seven, as well as how McQueen tried to steal attention from Brenner on scenes that had them together with all kinds of bits of business. Rounding out the cast of relative newcomers was James Coburn, Robert Vaughn before The Man from U.N.C.L.E., Charles Bronson before, well, being Charles Bronson, and a young German actor named Horst Buchholz, who made a little splash in Hollywood before returning to German films. Buchholz would play Chico, a combination of the hot-blooded Toshiro Mifune character from The Seven Samurai and the youngest of the seven who falls in love with a villager. It was no small part of The Magnificent Seven's success that each of these characters are given enough screen time to endear themselves to the audience. And thanks to Sturges' subtle direction, they do so without exaggerated theatrics or sentimentality. This is not a John Ford Western, after all. James Coburn has the least to say of them all, but lets his knife do the talking. It's safe to say that Sturges is at his best with an ensemble cast, or at least with strong supporting players. Bad Day at Blackrock, Gunfight at the OK Corral, and his most memorable, The Great Escape. Sturges may not be held in the highest esteem by auteurist critics. Andrew Saris puts him in the strained seriousness category in the American cinema, but he is far more watchable and less pretentious than, say, Richard Brooks, who also shares that category. Compare Brooks, for example, and his over-the-top Elmer Gantry, for example, from the same year as The Magnificent Seven. Sturges is not without a visual style either, or at least a visual preference. Often you'll see a figure in the foreground, usually speaking, while some action's going on in the near background, equally in focus. It's always to keep things going, which is great for action sequences. As in The Seven Samurai, the bandits are defeated and the village is saved, but at a cost of most of the seven. The Magnificent Seven was shot on locations in Mexico by the great Charles Lang, who must have just finished similar duties for Marlon Brando on One Eyed Jacks, even though that film was released the following year. And mention must be made of the rousing score and main theme for The Magnificent Seven by Elmer Bernstein. Often copied and sampled, it is listed as number 8 on the AFI's list of the top 25 American film scores. Magnificent Seven did okay business in its first release in major cities, but was a huge success when released in Europe. And in a rare case of commercial savvy, the film was released again in wider distribution in the U.S., where it was allowed to be discovered and appreciated. It's now seen as a kind of beginning of the new Western, opening the door for filmmakers like Peckinpah and Sergio Leone. This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jeff. And now we revisit an early film soleil via the new BFI book on Point Blank. There is a certain kind of writer who stands outside the general run of film writers, but who often comes up with compelling and interesting books or essays on film. Among them are Adam Mars Jones, the novelist, Michael Wood of the London Review of Books, and of course, Jeff Dyer. Jeff Dyer is the new master of the book-length single film study, first with Stalker, then Where Eagles Dare, and he has promised a volume on Point Blank. You might need to tear it all up and start over, as the British Film Institute has just published a monograph on Point Blank, written by Eric G. Wilson, and its 112 pages are packed with insights into the film, its making, and the times in which it was made. Point Blank began life as a novel, The Hunter, credited to Richard Stark, but in fact written by Donald Westlake. Westlake Stark continued to write more books in the Parker series of heist novels. There are approximately 24 Parker books in all, and even a few adaptations into graphic novels or comic books, or as we used to call them. And several were turned into films, such as The Outfit, The Split, Slayground, and Payback, which starred Mel Gibson as Porter and the later Parker, both of them ostensibly remakes or readaptations of Point Blank. Director John Borman had come out of British television and made his feature filmmaking debut with Having a Wild Weekend, also known as Catch Me If You Can, a film focusing on Beatle rivals the Dave Clark Five. A downbeat account of an off-season trip to the beach under grim gray skies crowding your shoulders. The Point Blank project came Borman's way via a special division of MGM, and he and his producer worked on the screenplay and eventually decided that Lee Marvin should play the character renamed Walker for the film. Marvin happened to be in London at the time shooting The Dirty Dozen, which would propel him into higher regions of Hollywood stardom than his earlier Oscar-winning turn in the Western comedy Cat Ballou had done. Borman moved his family to Los Angeles, worked on the screenplay further, sometimes with improvisational input from Lee Marvin, and came up with numerous innovative ideas incorporated into the texture of the film. MGM was also making another film with Michelangelo Antonioni called Zabriskie Point, and the two films coincidentally share a fascination with Los Angeles, its weather and architecture, as Mr. Wilson points out in his book. In its cinematic form, Point Blank begins hypnotically in media res at the tail end of a heist gone wrong, at least wrong for Walker, who is betrayed by his wife and best friend and shot and left at the heist site, which happens to be Alcatraz.
Walker is an emotional and primitive man. Lee Marvin is Walker, the hunter and the hunted.
Meet Walker.
He makes my flesh crawl.
Well, what do you really want?
I really want my money.
I want my 93 grand.
I want my money.
What follows is Walker's implacable pursuit of the funds owed him, which takes him back to Los Angeles to track down his wife, played by Sharon Acker, and the best friend, played by John Vernon, and eventually up a crime organization's food chain until he comes within reach of his money. Marvin's character is not unlike an earlier portrayal from 1964 as one of the title characters in the Don Siegel adaptation, The Killers. Eric Wilson is professor of English at Wake Forest University. His previous books include Secret Cinema, Gnostic Vision in Film, and a book about David Lynch, and he's appeared in the New York Times among other publications. The first chapter, The Grail, explains how the project came about, and the second chapter, Minimalism, charts the evolution of the screenplay and the influence of Alain René and Harold Pinter. Quote, "Trauma shatters the boundary between past and present. So immense is the pain that the sufferer can't stop thinking about it, and so the past is just as real as the present, sometimes indistinguishable from it. But if the present is the past, is the present really occurring? Has the past passed?" A film about a tortured character who confuses past and present, Point Blank also disorients time, as well as space, But Borman's movie doesn't only fracture its images, it also fragments its speech, inspired by the minimalism of Pinter. In plays like The Homecoming and scripts like The Servant, Pinter's terse dialogue and awkward pauses hint at a barely repressed menace. Brothers insinuate resentment while talking about a cheese roll. A couple invites suspicion in discussing where a vase of flowers should go. It's what's not said that resonates most powerfully. This ominous indirection characterizes Marvin's speech in Point Blank. His character's trauma is too deep for words, so he sits in awkward silence or grimly repeats the same clipped questions. Chapter 3, Stoic and Clown, focuses on Marvin and the casting in general of Angie Dickinson, Vernon, and Carol O'Connor, among others. And with Chapter 4, Los Angeles, he analyzes Borman's approach to the city itself and its architecture, and registers it as the birthplace for subsequent films such as Zabriskie Point and some films by Jacques Demy. Los Angeles is contrasted with the set of the abandoned Alcatraz prison in San Francisco, metallic and cold, machinery and enclosures, which he then cites as a visual motif throughout the rest of the film. Here, too, he also covers the cinematographer Philip Lathrop, the set designers, and the score provided by Jerry Mandel. He writes, "Compared to the rest of the film, the opening in Alcatraz is extremely short, only about 8% of the overall running time. But the prison haunts the movie, its enclosing lines crossing almost every scene. Walker walks out of his dead wife's room and looks through a window screen that resembles a prison fence. He squats in the corner of Lynn's empty apartment, and nearby window panes resemble prison bars. The rectangular windows on the organization's office building also recall the jail cell, as do the Venetian blinds in a mobster's office. But linear imagery isn't the only way Alcatraz pervades the film. The actual prison returns in Walker's many flashbacks. To this traumatized man, almost every event jolts him back to the moment he was gunned down in the empty cell. Point Blank is an agon between the claustrophobic configurations of Alcatraz and the vacuous surfaces of the city. If the former suggests limbo, the latter intimates vertigo. Is the limbo stasis or preparation? Is the dizziness disorientation or liberation? That we must look at shapes to consider these questions implies a moral geometry, not unlike the one in Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, where modern horizontal designs collide with looming Gothic mansards. In chapters 5 through 11, the author walks us through the film moment to moment, point by point, in various chapters, including titles such as The Movie House, Golden Androgyny, Ironic Genre, and Neurotic Inertia. Finally, in a chapter about the afterlife of the film, he describes the post-production, the ad campaign, and its eventual cult status and various re-releases. The book is rounded out with footnotes, the credits, and a bibliography from which the reader could compile a nice separate anthology of essential essays on Point Blank. Here's how Mr. Wilson concludes the book. Point Blank was released on Blu-ray in 2005. The extras include commentary by Steven Soderbergh and John Borman, and in 2013 was released again in theaters. The BFI staged a retrospective of Borman's work in 2014, and Point Blank was a prominent part of the celebrations. Walker's LAX shoes were on display. From Bloomington to London, the shoes traveled, and still in every showing of Point Blank, they hammer the earth. They mark the restlessness the film so indelibly pounds home, the relentlessness of pain and Grace's perseverance, that the torment and the mercy need one another to exist, but also remain blind to each other's presences, is one of the film's most profound and troubling revelations. Marvin's anguished tenderness and Borman's dazzling fractures embody this vexed paradox of unity and brokenness, as do some of the blackest comedies of our time and the most ecstatic tragedies." Close quote. This is all terrific stuff. but it also makes me await the Jeff Dyer version even more. Well, there you have it, and thank you for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday, so until then, keep watching the screens.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO just finished our All Thrills, No Frills special program.